This meeting is now being recorded.
Hello all, this is Elliot Schoenberg, the International Director of Placement for the Joint Placement Commission and the Rabbinical Assembly. I am joined on this call by Kathy Elias, Regional Administrator, District Administrator for the United Synagogue Mid-Atlantic Region of the United Synagogue. This is a joint venture of the Joint Placement Commission, the Rabbinical Assembly, and the United Synagogue. Our topic is the RA United Synagogue Model Contract, and I am very pleased that our guest today is Mr. Scott Kaplan, Esquire, International Vice President of the United Synagogue, has served for the last 7 years as the General Counsel to the United Synagogue, and important to this call, was the Chief Architect and the Chief Negotiator on behalf of the United Synagogue of the Model Contract when it was created some time ago. Scott, thank you so much for joining us in today's call.
It was my pleasure, Rabbi Schoenberg. I've been looking forward to this.
Great. So, Scott, why don't you take a couple of moments and tell us how this Model Contract came into being.
Be happy to. And I know you will recall, many years ago, we were absolutely inundated with questions from both rabbis and congregations as to what is expected in terms of a model contract. Rabbis would meet with congregations and have no idea what to expect in terms not only of compensation, but of what is moreh da'atra, what outside activities is a rabbi allowed to engage in. How do we handle funerals and other life cycle events and honoraria that follows? How do we handle severance? What's to be expected regarding life insurance coverage, health insurance coverage? Everybody was operating from a different page. Similarly, congregations had no idea what rabbis were expecting in terms not only of compensation, but of all other issues. What type of pension plan retirement to ask for? All kinds of questions were emanating not only from rabbis, but from congregations as well. And so we determined that if all of us could start with the same page, and if there could be some type of uniformity of expectations, and if various questions were answered uniformly, then congregations would know how to address rabbinic issues, and similarly, rabbis would know what to expect. And so, therefore, we set about on a 3-year process to create a model contract, not binding on every party, to be sure, but to deal with the crucial elements of the deal, the essential elements of the deal, in an attempt to come up with uniformity between the United Synagogue representing the congregations and the Rabbinical Assembly representing the rabbis. As you know, because you were part of it, negotiating teams were formed. Every issue was discussed at length, debated, compromises were made, positions were asserted, but we came up with a model contract that addressed almost every issue to be considered in creating an engagement agreement. And in that manner, I can tell you from my own personal experience that the issues on the table were minimalized, agreements were reached much more quickly, tension and friction disappeared, and each party knew what to expect when they sat down with the other party to negotiate. It has done us well.
Great. Thanks, Scott. So just to go, just talk about the binding or not binding nature of this document. Congregation must use it, should use it, has to use it. Rabbi must use it, has to use it. Is it binding? Is it a guideline? What's the language would you use to describe it?
Listen, we understand that rabbis individually have unique interests, have unique concerns, just like congregations have unique interests and concerns. No attempt is made to muzzle either the rabbi or the congregation when it comes to the essential elements of the deal. And so, therefore, quite clearly, the model contract is not binding on any of its issues regarding rabbi and congregation. We like to look at it, however, as a little bit more than just a guideline. of the issues to be considered and the issues to be discussed. We like to look at this contract as the standards that each party should try as hard as possible to reach. And so while we understand that each party is free to negotiate any and every term they wish, in fact, we urge each party to consult their own individual attorneys, their own individual accountants and advisors, to consider the local laws of the area in which they reside, the local minhagim of the congregations involved. Clearly, the contract is not binding, but it is more than just a guideline. It is a statement by each organization that certain things should be in the contract. Life insurance coverage should be in the contract. Health insurance, retirement fund contribution should be in the contract. A definition of what Moed Da'atra is and the latitude that a rabbi has or does not have in changing congregational customs and minhagim. All of those issues should be discussed and should be in the contract in some form or fashion. Bottom line, it is not binding. However, the provisions in the model contract are where the United Synagogue and the Rabbinical Assembly stand on the resolution of those issues.
So, Scott, if it's not binding, why would a United Synagogue congregation want to use this document? What's the advantage to the individual congregation if it actually used this contract?
Listen, as I tell people all the time, there is one time in the life of congregation and rabbi when we expect each party to look out for their own best interests, and that is during contract negotiation time. And we also understand that that is a time that is probably fraught with the most tension and the most friction and the most discomfort as each party tries to do what is best for himself. We want all of our United Synagogue congregations to understand that certain terms and provisions ought to be uniform, and they ought to be uniformly addressed. And they ought to be, in our view, uniformly addressed by every congregation, large or small, whether located in a large metropolitan area or in some small town somewhere. And so, therefore, I have found personally that whereas before the model contract was created, questions came in on a daily basis regarding what is right, what is wrong, what is expected, what is unexpected. But most importantly, where does the United Synagogue stand on issues such as honoraria, such as outside activities of the rabbi, such as disability benefits, such as how should the parsonage be maintained and who should pay for what? All of these are very important issues, and we have found that if individual congregations know in advance where the United Synagogue stands on those issues, as described in the model contract, that the tension and the friction and the discomfort in negotiation is minimalized and often eliminated.
Can congregations consult with the United Synagogue, or how do congregations consult with the United Synagogue about the contract? What do they do?
We urge all of our congregations to be in close contact with the district directors of each district in the area in which they reside. The district directors are or should be well aware of the terms and provisions of the model contract. The district director should be well aware of what rabbis in that particular area have a right to ask for, have a right to demand, and similarly what the congregations have the right to ask for and demand. There are obviously issues where district directors themselves need help, and that's when it often comes to my desk as the general counsel of the United Synagogue. However, the New York office is well equipped to advise congregations on contractual issues and even better equipped to refer them to the appropriate professional within our organization. We have, as you know, Elliot, because you serve on the Committee on Congregational Standards. It is where disputes are resolved. It is where discussion takes place regarding open issues. And so congregations often, and we urge them to seek advice, firstly from their own district director, and then from the national office, and then from general counsel himself.
Great. So you already mentioned mediation and arbitration. Would you briefly describe that clause in the contract, and what's the advantage to a congregation to including the clause about mediation and arbitration in the contract?
Look, we believe that all disputes between synagogues and not only rabbis, but all clergy and all professionals are disputes for the sake of heaven, Laban HaShemayim. And they are disputes between family members. And so we start off with the proposition that any dispute between rabbi and congregation is similar to a dispute between family members and ought to be resolved within the family, or as we say, within the tent. God forbid, we feel, that disputes should become public, should find expression in the press, or expression in the courts, which always then find reference in the press. And so we seek to resolve all of our disputes within our own tent, within our own family. And so when a dispute arises, either a dispute originated by the rabbi or a dispute originated by the congregation, the parties are urged, and the model contract actually requires, and frankly we're proud of that requirement, the model contract requires that disputes be resolved through the offices of the Rabbinical Assembly and the United Synagogue Committee on Congregational Standards. And what often happens is that first mediation is attempted, and if that doesn't succeed, then formal arbitration takes place. In my view, Elliot, you may disagree, the vast majority of disputes are resolved by mediation. Often, the congregation contacts the district director, informs the district director of the United Synagogue of the dispute. The district director often mediates it to himself or herself, or assigns somebody within the local vicinity to attempt to mediate. Everybody knows what mediation is, simply informal meetings and discussions and attempts to come to arrive at a compromise. And in my view, well over three-fourths of all of our disputes are resolved through informal mediation. But when that fails, then our system provides for a formal arbitration process, wherein proper forms are filled out with the Committee on Congregational Standards. The process is overseen by the chairman of that committee, but the rules are very similar to the American Arbitration Society, whereby the rabbi appoints an arbitrator to represent his interests and to argue his case, and the synagogue appoints an arbitrator to do the very same thing on behalf of the congregation, and then the two arbitrators themselves select a third arbitrator who serves as the chairman of the arbitration panel. It is handled as an informal legal proceeding where each party appears before the three-person arbitration panel, presents any evidence deemed appropriate, any testimony, any governing precedent or governing minhagim, and the three arbitrators hear the case, hear the testimony, hear the evidence, and a vote is taken and a decision is made which is binding upon the parties. In that manner, go ahead.
Now, Scott, I was going to say that many of the disputes hopefully are resolved before they actually go to binding mediation and arbitration by either the district administrator or some other kind of informal process, and we have found that fewer and fewer of the disputes actually get there, in the sense, just like in the court system, that so many things get resolved before they actually come to court, because we have this system in place, and there may be some insecurity as to how it might be resolved. Often the disputes get resolved before the formal hearing because there's a system in place to do the process.
That is, and I know you, Elliot, yourself, have resolved countless disputes by simply informally talking to the parties and arriving at a compromise that suited everyone.
Okay, Scott, so let's ask about So, first of all, ladies and gentlemen on the call, this is Mocha Mondays for Congregations. This is Rabbi Elliot Schoenberg, the International Director of Placement of the Joint Placement Commission. I'm joined by Kathy Elias, District Administrator of the United Synagogue Mid-Atlantic Office. Our guest today is Mr. Scott Kaplan, Esquire, the Chief Architect of the Model Contract between the United Synagogue and the Rabbinical Assembly, currently serving as General Counsel to the United Synagogue as well, and a friend of congregations and rabbis alike. I want to welcome everyone. I want to remind everyone they can send any questions they may have to my email address, eschoenberg, E-S-C-H-O-E-N-B-E-R-G, at rabbinicalassembly1word.org, eschoenberg at rabbinicalassembly.org. Scott, talk to me and to everyone on the call, please, a little bit about the clause that describes Maradatra, because in prior histories, in another model contract that existed before this one, there was no language about Maradatra. What does the language have to say about Maradatra, and why is that important?
It's an interesting concept because of all of the issues in the contract that are non-monetary in nature, this is probably the one that is most on the mind, not only of the rabbi, but of the congregation itself, and that is the role of Maradatra. First and foremost, the United Synagogue recognizes and accepts and, in fact, publicizes the fact that the rabbi of the congregation is indeed the Mora D'Atra in the true Talmudic sense of the word. That is, the rabbi is the halakhic decisor. The senior rabbi of the congregation is the sole halakhic decisor within the congregation, and his decision is indeed final. That having been said, and as all rabbis on this call will recognize, the issue of changes in congregational custom.
Scott, there's only one rabbi on this call that I know of, actually me, I hope.
Right. That helps me.
We have on the call are chairs of search committee and members of search committee.
Good. Rabbis and congregations are mostly concerned about this role of Mora D'Atra, and in terms of congregational life, how that will impact upon changes to rituals and rites and customs of the congregation. Listen, let's be honest. Many of our congregations, our smaller ones, engage rabbis more often than do the larger congregations in our organization. Often, rabbis come for 3, 4, 5, even 6 or 7 years, and then they depart for other pastures. And there's great concern about what changes such a rabbi will make when he appears upon the scene. And so, therefore, we deal very, very carefully with that issue in the model contract, declaring that clearly the rabbi is the Mora D'Atra. There is a provision in the contract regarding change in ritual or practice. In fact, the contract says in its face that whenever contemplating a change in ritual or practice, the rabbi must act with sensitivity and respect for the congregation's prior history and customs and traditions. And therefore, changes that are made that are not necessarily of a halakhic nature. And I will tell you that most changes are of a halakhic nature, but there are changes that are not. For instance, what floors to use and how to set up chairs. All of us can think of issues that are not necessarily halakhic. And so, therefore, those types of changes may be made by the rabbi only upon prior consultation with and approval of the board of directors. But whenever making any changes, such as going from a full Torah reading to a triennial, or any changes that are clearly of a halakhic nature, the rabbi is free to make those changes, but he obligates himself contractually to act with sensitivity and respect for prior history, and to take prior history and customs and traditions into consideration. And in that way, he realizes that he is not the last rabbi that will ever serve on that bima, and that whatever changes made or will be changes that will have to be dealt with by future generations of rabbis and congregants. And so the contract recognizes the issue and deals with it by requiring sensitivity and by requiring some degree of respect for prior history.
Right. So let's separate out for the moment just to clarify that there are really two agenda items here on this one, which is there was a question of who is the religious authority of the congregation, and then the second question is how are changes made in a congregation.
Yes.
There was a separation in this conversation where there was no dispute as to who the religious authority was. It was not the ritual committee, and it wasn't the president of the synagogue. It was, in fact, the rabbi named to be the spiritual leader.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, there was an issue as to who owns halakha and who owns minhag, and what's the difference between the two. So an example of that might be, can a synagogue have late Friday night services or not? That's a halachic question. Once the rabbi would rule that a synagogue could have late Friday night services, the question as to what time that service might be, that's not halacha. That very well may be the custom. So what happens? Where was the conflict? The conflict was that a synagogue for many years held its late Friday evening service at 8 o'clock. A new rabbi would come, and a new rabbi would suggest, oh, late Friday night services should be at 7:30. The conversation that took place between the negotiators was that the time, whether it's 7:30 or 8 o'clock, that's not halakha. That's very much inside in keeping with the custom of the congregation, and that the authority about the time of a late Friday night service very much rested with the congregation and not with the rabbi.
Well,
that makes sense, Scott?
Indeed it does. And interestingly enough, another example that has come to my desk on several times is the rabbi of the congregation realizing that the sanctuary is large and wants everyone to sit up front and together, ropes off the side sections, or may rope off the back of the synagogue to require that people sit together and sit up front. The question has come up, is that a halakhic issue? And everyone has agreed thus far that that is not a halakhic issue, and whether you can rope off the side sections or rope off the back section is an issue that a rabbi can deal with, but ought to deal with, in consultation with and with agreement of the lay leadership of the congregation. Sometimes, as you know, Elliot, there are gray issues. They are both halakhic and non-halakhic. We always try to err on the side of rabbinic authority. The rabbi owns the bima in many respects. We do have issues in the model contract regarding freedom of expression on the bima. And we do not permit our rabbis, for instance, to take positions on the bima that violate the standards of the rabbinical assembly. But by and large, the rabbi is in control of the bima, and lay leadership is controlled off the bima, except on issues of halacha, where the rabbi is in control throughout the facility.
Right. It was very important to put language into the model contract on these matters, that the rabbi act with sensitivity and flexibility, and key language there, which was respecting the history of the congregation. So that the tension here is, you want someone to lead, you want someone to make changes. At the same time, you want changes to be made in a way that respected the history of the congregation. And there will always be tension around this, and we understood that and respected that, and wanted to find some language that encapsulated sensitivity to that.
And really, it also addressed the issue of the congregation that finds itself with a new rabbi every 3 or 4 or 5 years. And there was a concern that a rabbi would come in and institute a substantial change and then depart. And so that gave rise to the language that we have found has worked quite well over the years. And to my knowledge, there have been very, very, very few issues regarding the role of the rabbi and halakhic decision-making.
Great. I just got a question by email, which was, what is the typical length of a first contract? Remembering, Scott, that everyone on this call is looking for a rabbi, so that they will be bringing in new rabbis into their congregations, hopefully this summer.
Listen, you know as well as I do, but the problem, the rabbinic problem is that almost by definition, when a rabbi gets a job or when a rabbi changes a job, he must uproot his family, leave like our forefathers did, leave and go to a new place and set up a new home. And so therefore there was great feeling that if a rabbi is brought to a community and he has to move his whole household there and set up a new home and enroll his children in school, that it had to be for a significant period of time. And whenever that question is asked of me, I always answer that a first-year term ought to be somewhere between 3 and 5 years. We have found that between 3 and 5 years is a substantial enough investment by the congregation in giving the rabbi an opportunity to excel and to prosper and to flourish. And also, rabbis have felt that a 3 to 5 year commitment was sufficient to enable them to uproot themselves from where they are and go to where the new congregation is. Having said that, I have also said that when dealing with a senior rabbinic position, closer to 5 years than 3, and when dealing with an assistant rabbinic position, probably closer to 3 years than to 5. But Elliot, I imagine you might have something to say that about that as well. But we have found 3 to 5 years is the typical first term.
I like that. I mean, I wouldn't start with tenure, but I like what you have to say.
I like it.
That's very good. Going back to some questions about content on the contract itself, there is a pretty lengthy paragraph there about severance. And I have so why don't you talk a little bit about why the severance clause is in the contract, where it came from, what's the advantage to the congregation of having that severance clause in the contract?
Listen, we all know, as I said earlier, that if a rabbi changes jobs, it almost always means by definition that he must change homes and he must change communities. And so therefore, letting a rabbi go, even for a good reason, often leaves the rabbi homeless, and more often than not, almost always requires, as I said, that he uproot himself. So therefore, we set about to establish a system that we deem to be fair and equitable, whereby if a rabbi had established himself within a community and had devoted substantial time and longevity to that position, some recognition must be made to the cost, not just the economic, but the non-economic, emotional cost of a rabbi in departing one community and going to another. And indeed, there's a corporate model, as everybody knows. Corporations pay severance when they terminate long-term employees who have made long-term investments of time and effort and lifestyle in order to enable that employee to find another position within a reasonable period of time. Now, up until the time that we negotiated the model contract, rabbis took the position that what was fair and reasonable was 1 month's salary for every year with the congregation. And so, therefore, a congregation that sought to terminate a rabbi after 20 or 30 years, often for good reason, might find itself having to come up with 2 or 3 years' salary to terminate the rabbi. So, therefore, there was great debate and great discussion over what was fair and what was reasonable. And we knew that if we could agree upon it, the two organizations, that there would be no disputes, there would be no lawsuits, there would be no arguments. Everyone would understand to the dollar what the severance obligation would be. And so therefore, after an incredible amount of not just negotiation, but research and communication, a formula was arrived at whereby a congregation is free to terminate its rabbi after the expiration of a contract. Never can a rabbi be terminated without cause during the term of a contract, but after the expiration of a contract, if a rabbi has been with the congregation for approximately 7 years, a severance pay obligation kicks in. It is somewhat minimal during years 7, 8, and 9. It becomes a bit more significant after years 10 or 11 or 12. But a compromise was reached and a formula was arrived at, and now a congregation knows that if it keeps a rabbi beyond a certain period of time, it has made a moral and ethical commitment to that rabbi. And if they seek to then terminate that rabbi, even without cause, there is a corresponding financial commitment as well.
Thank you.
It has worked well. I'm not aware of any disputes because everybody knows the numbers and everybody knows the time frames involved.
Right. So one of the reason why this is important for a conversation for first contracts is, from my point of view, and Kathy, you might be able to respond to this as well, that this is, in some ways, the point of the model contract that is often left out. Of all of the clauses, this is the one that is often, is most often missing. I want to reiterate to everyone is that the language here says that for the first 5 years, there's no severance due. So there's no harm done by putting it in their contract. Yet congregations often are silent on the matter, and when it is silent on the matter and it happens, it almost always goes to mediation and arbitration for the United Synagogue Committee on Congregational Standards. And we're trying, this is one way to avoid the dispute by putting it into the system. Scott, I got another question.
I mean, I will tell you that in terms of corporate severance, and I hesitate to say this with Elliot on the line, but in terms of corporate severance, it is relatively low. For instance, if you decide to send your rabbi elsewhere after 9 years of service, there's an obligation to pay 9 months, 9 months' salary as severance pay. Quite minimal if one looks at the corporate model.
Good. Thank you. Let's have another question, which is, how does one obtain a copy of the RA United Synagogue model contract? Where can it be found?
Well, it is certainly, I believe it is on the United Synagogue's website. Elliot, you will tell us if it is on the Rabbinical Assembly's website. We distribute our model contract to every congregation upon request. Requests need merely be made to the district director or even to the national office. And I know, Elliot, that when you create packages to send out to young rabbis who are soliciting employment, I believe it is part of the contract. It is my understanding that it is well publicized and it is made easily available upon request by both of our respective offices.
Correct. Actually, next week, this is the class I'm teaching in the rabbinical school with the rabbinical students going over the clauses in the model contract. For those of you who are in e-placement and you have an account, if you go into your e-placement account and go to the help page, you can download a copy of the model contract. And to reiterate what Scott said, you can certainly be in contact with any of your district administrators to obtain a copy from them directly.
And I would, this is Kat Elias. I would say that you can also go to the United Synagogue website, and on the homepage under Leadership and Administration, under Leadership is the Committee for Congregational Standards, and all of the links are there under Committee for Congregational Standards.
Scott, you want to say a few words, since everyone on this call is about to engage with a rabbi, is how they might go about negotiating a first contract with a rabbi?
Listen, every single rabbi that I have ever met has been different from the other, and every congregation I've ever visited has been different from the other. But I will tell you that as a result of the model contract, the parties commenced negotiations almost on the same page. And therefore, very few surprises come up during the initial conversations. But I have always found it to be an extremely rewarding experience. It is in the nature of relationship building. And so whenever we have met with a young rabbi right out of the seminary, or a young rabbi who has been assistant for 2 or 3 years elsewhere, the rabbi has never been bashful, indicating what he or she thinks is appropriate, both in terms of monetary issues and non-monetary issues. The congregations, of course, have never been bashful in letting the rabbi know what their expectations were, whether they're educational expectations, teaching classes, conducting meetings, morning minion issues, afternoon minion issues. My experience has been that all parties have always been open and forthright, because all parties realize that a marriage is about to take place. Indeed, Elliot, you recall it was very important to me that we call this document not an employment agreement, but an engagement agreement. And one may smile, but that's very important. The relationship between congregation and rabbi is not that of employer-employee. It is more in the nature of partnership, even husband-wife, creating family relationships. And so by calling it an engagement agreement rather than an employment agreement, I think that we make a very, very important point, and that is this is a relationship document. And by the way, the more issues that are dealt with and resolved and placed in the contract, the less possibility there is for dispute. Elliot is right. Even though there is no severance during the first 5 years, even if you negotiate a 3-year contract with a rabbi out of school, the severance provision ought to be there so everybody knows from the get-go not only what the expectations are for the next 3 years, but even beyond. So we regard this as a relationship-building exercise, and the more issues that are discussed and agreed upon, the less opportunity there is for disagreement, tension, and friction.
Great. Final question. One of our participants on the call asked, is it a good idea to spell out or quantify what are the rabbi's specific duties or expectations? I'll translate a little bit. Should there be a job description attached to a rabbinic contract? What's your opinion about that?
But from our point of view, the answer is an unequivocal yes. And that is the greater detail that is dealt with in terms of actual job expectations, the less tension and friction and disagreement there will be. If the rabbi is to attend the morning minion at 7:15 a.m. and the education committee meeting at 8 o'clock p.m., that ought to be in the job description. If the rabbi is expected to conduct Shiva Minyanim at Shiva houses, visit the sick in hospitals, counsel newly married couples, engage couples, I do not believe, for one, that one can possibly go into too much detail. I believe the greater the detail, the greater the chances are of success between the two parties. Even if you get down to silly stuff, I think it ought to be in there. The more detail, the better.
So my point of view on that, this is Elliot Schoenberg speaking, little bit different than that, which is, first, I don't know if Scott would disagree with this piece, but it's important to describe roles before you do specific job descriptions. The rabbi should be worship leader. The rabbi should be spiritual director. The rabbi should be an educational presence.
Right, right. But that is in the body of the contract, as you well know, Elliot.
But one needs to be careful, as when I advise rabbis about contracts, if it specifically says that the rabbi, the difference between saying the rabbi should attend morning minyan and that the rabbi should attend morning minyan every Monday. If the rabbi does not attend morning minyan on a Monday, technically in violation by the job description of the contract. So one needs to be mindful of such nuances when scripting the actual language that it's actually doable and also reasonable. Does that make sense, Scott?
Oh, yeah. We do not expect our rabbis to punch a clock. We know that our rabbis put in far, far more than 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. We know that the rabbi's hours on a daily basis begin early in the morning, and often they end late at night. And so we recognize that, but having said that, if there's an expectation the rabbi must attend minyan, that ought to be reflected in the contract. If there's an expectation the rabbi will attend education committee meetings, youth activity committee meetings, cultural arts committee meetings, and so forth, that ought to find reflection in the contract. Neither party should ever look at the other and say, I didn't know I was supposed to do that.
Great. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we've reached the conclusion of our call. My name is Elliot Schoenberg. I'm the International Director of Placement for the Pinnacle Assembly. Joining me today has been Kathy Elias of the United Synagogue, District Administrator for the Mid-Atlantic Region, and our guest, Mr. Scott Kaplan, Esquire, General Counsel to the United Synagogue, and an advisor and friend and teacher to many of us. Scott, we'd like to thank you for your participation today. It has been enlightening and, as always, thorough, and entertaining. Thank you all.
Elliot, may I invite anyone to call me personally. It is what we do for our congregations, and you know you have referred many individual rabbis to me as well. I like nothing better than to talk to our congregations and to our rabbis about any unique issues.
Great. I'd like to remind everyone that the next call will be on March the 7th, Monday, March the 7th, same time, 12:15. Thank you all very much.